For those of you actually, while people coming in now, sitting at the front, you may notice the camera in front here because we're experimenting to try and put the Dhamma talks on the web, on video streaming. Last week it didn't really work too well because it was just too dark, so little by little we're making some experiments, trying to see eventually if on a Friday night, if you're tired, you can sit at home and you can see and hear exactly what's going on. Not only in Perth, but if you have to go overseas, wherever you go, you can actually tune in and listen to the Friday night talk. Even if you die from those realms beyond this earth, if they have computers, you'll still be able to catch up on what's happening at the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Okay. So I did mention a few moments ago, before we started the meditation, I'd just come back from another teaching tour of Melbourne for a couple of days. And the main reason I went over there was for a symposium on the Buddhist meaning of happiness. And part of that symposium, there was a psychologist, and I followed him. It was fascinating to see the differences between Buddhism and psychology. And I think I'm going to make that the subject of this evening's talk. Sort of Buddhism and some aspects of modern psychology. Because Buddhism has been a psychology in and of itself for over 2,500 years. It's been very successful in understanding the workings of the mind and learning how to adapt one's ideas, ambitions, drives, in order to be conducive to happiness, fulfillment, meaning in life, whatever. And so Buddhist psychology has actually stood the test of time and been very, very effective. And we also have like Western psychology, which has got a large influence on people's lives. And sometimes many of you may have to go and see a psychologist and deal with some of the problems in your life. However, many of you, I hope, won't need to even to go to a psychologist, because you come and learn at a Buddhist monastery about how your mind works and some of the ideas and frameworks of understanding. And I think you'll probably find that the Buddhist understanding of the mind is even more deep, more powerful, and more effective. But in particular, that the goal of a psychology would be mostly just dealing with people who are suffering, and actually bringing them to a state of ease in their life. Now, of course, the idea of state of ease and happiness and how it's attained is not quite the same in modern psychology as what we have in Buddhism. And in particular, very ideas of happiness and peace are very, very different. And so that the differences, or the looking at Buddhism and psychology, or looking at psychology in the framework of Buddhism, becomes a very fascinating area to find out some deeper insights into the meaning of life. In particular, that modern psychology, so I heard, it was only last night, I was at that symposium in Melbourne, that modern psychology has the idea that people suffer and they get into psychological trauma because sometimes they tend to think they're losing control of their life and their happiness, and that when we sense a disempowerment of our life, that we are not in control of our time, our happiness, we feel a lot of times a lot of stress, a lot of suffering, a lot of angst. And I can understand that that is one of the great sources of trouble in people's life. Somebody dies, we don't want them to die, or our body has got a sickness and it's out of control, or our sort of relationship, and it's just whatever we do, it seems to get worse, or our job, or the whole of life, it seems we become powerless. And for many people that's so frustrating, it causes them psychological suffering. And of course we agree with that. In Buddhism it's called not getting what you want is suffering. It's the first teaching of the Buddha in the Four Noble Truths. However, the response of psychology and the response of Buddhism is very different. If you read a psychology book or a self-help book, with the exception of opening the door of your heart, That's my book. If you read a psychology book or listen to the TV or go to a seminar, you'll find many people who want to solve the problem of feeling out of control in life by exerting our will even more, having goals in life, regaining control, what sometimes we say, grabbing the day. In Buddhism, we have the opposite idea. Because what happens in Buddhism is instead of trying to control more, in Buddhism we try and control less. Not more, but less. Because what happens if we try and control more, if we take our life in hand and really start to do things and make affirmations, yes, we're certainly going to do this. Do you want to be rich? Think dollars. Think rich. Envisage your wealth and you will become rich. Stupid, isn't it? No one can become rich like that. Who wants to become rich anyway? But the point is that very often we buy into these affirmations and thinking that once we have this affirmation, everything will work. Once we take control, then our lives will be happy ever after. But the point is, you're just putting off the inevitable. Putting off the inevitable realization that you may succeed for a short time, but eventually that things will go wrong. Not really wrong, they're going right. But your ideas are being challenged about who's in control of this life. Even if you are successful, eventually you'll die. And just your children or the tax office will get all your money. Either way, you will not have it afterwards. You may succeed at while in your business and have some prosperity, but eventually you'll have to suffer the ups and downs of the economic cycle. Boom and bust. It'll always be that way. Always has been. And there's nothing much we can do about it. Even your relationships, they may go well for a while, but they'll have trouble because that is life. Life is that things do not go according to our wishes. And even affirmations which people have when they have cancers. And they try their very best, but for many people who have great affirmations, even people who meditate, sometimes they die. In fact, they all die, eventually. Now the point is here that things do go wrong. Or I say they do go right. We die, we get sick, we lose things, we gain things, that is life. So in Buddhism, we realize actually that truth of things. We're not into wishful thinking and thinking that this world is this heavenly place where if we could only sort of understand the rules of the game and play accordingly, then everything will go right, we'll be happy ever after. This is not a happy ever after world. This is not a fairy tale, as many of you know from your direct experience. So that type of psychology is actually doomed to create more problems. If they say that take more control over your life, so you're more in command of your time and your happiness, you'll find that does not work. What we do in Buddhist psychology is actually to understand, yes, this is life, this is part of our world, this is our body, it gets sick, it gets healthy, it ages, it starts off beautiful, it ends up ugly. And that is true for each one of us, isn't it wonderful? When we accept that, when we don't try and control it, we don't try and have cosmetic surgery or sort of hair implants or other implants. Perhaps I need hair implants, I'm always bald. But the point is that we're more in tune with the flow of life, which means that some of life will be unpleasant, some will be happy, but we let go of controlling. In Buddhism, we don't have more control. Now that is actually also rhymes with the other aspect of modern psychology, which I heard yesterday, which is actually to have a sense of integrity, a sense of self, a sense of who you are. I've been a monk for many years now. I've been trying all these years to get rid of myself. To have no idea who I am. Many, many years ago, there was a monk who visited here, We still have some of the tapes, I believe, in the library. We certainly have these recorded tapes in our monastery. And I alerted my younger monks to this great teacher and just how wonderful, how funny he was. Many of you remember him, Venerable Ananda Mangala, a Sri Lankan monk who was in Singapore for many years. And I sort of remember sort of some of the, you know, the teachings which, you know, which he would give. But somebody once asked him sort of if he was enlightened. And his response was, well, I can't really say that, but what I can say is I'm highly illuminated. And that's a beautiful answer, being highly illuminated. Because, you know, it rhymes with being illuminated, but it wasn't a slip of the tongue. It didn't mean I'm highly illuminated. It meant I am highly illuminated. And that gave a wonderful indication of his understanding of the Buddhist path to happiness. It's not actually getting a stronger sense of self, not a bigger ego, but actually the smaller ego, getting the sort of the sense of being eliminated, eliminating the controller, the doer, the me. So now that was the way to health, to psychological health in Buddhism. Now I think you can understand what is meant there. Because when you have a sense of self and identity, the point is that we attach to that, which means it's fixed, our idea of who we are. And psychology will tell you to have a strong sense of who you are. Buddhism will say the opposite. Whatever you think you are is only a temporary fix. And the quicker you let that go, the more able you will be able to change and be able to flow with the inevitable alteration of this, you know, thing we call me and mine. You'll be able to allow yourself to be brilliant sometimes, and other times as stupid. Our problem is, if we think we're stupid, then of course we're attached to that, we'll always be stupid. We won't allow ourselves to be brilliant. When we're brilliant all the time, we won't allow the stupidity to come up. The truth of you and the truth of me is sometimes you are brilliant, sometimes you are stupid, and a lot of the time you are in between. Which one is the real you? None of them is the real you. You allow yourself to change. You allow yourself to morph with the seasons of, you know, intelligence and stupidity, happiness and suffering, clarity and dullness. You allow yourself to change between being high and being depressed. One of the problems is when people are depressed, they don't like being depressed. And they want to try and control it, to grab the day, to be someone else. What's wrong with being depressed? Who made these laws that it's wrong to be depressed? Enjoy your depression. Make a stand for depressed people's rights. Now, of course, when you do that, like somebody asked me in Melbourne, I'm bored, what should I do with my boredom? Psychologically, how is a young person, how can I get out of my boredom? And my answer was, I said, make a study of boredom. Find out what it feels like when you're bored. Like, first of all, start off physically in your body. What sensations can you notice about boredom? What does it feel in your chest, or in your legs, or in your heart? Is there anything there, any sort of symptom of boredom? Things which you can only feel in your body when you're bored, which you don't feel at other times. And number two, actually, is there different levels of boredom? Like, you know, being sort of ordinary bored, or very bored, or mega bored? Or, you know, how many different levels? And how does it change, you know, between like being really bored, or just ordinary bored, or middle bored? And actually, what does it feel like? How do you know which one it is? Make a study of this. And I told you, actually, boredom is a very interesting subject. And if you make a study of boredom, maybe actually you can actually print your research in a scientific paper and become a doctor or famous. Do your own little study in boredom. Become an expert in boredom. Now, of course, when you start doing this, you know, because you're interested in boredom, you're not trying to get rid of it, but you're actually fascinated by it. You're not bored anymore. So that's how to get rid of being bored. So the point of the story was that, first of all, you don't try to get rid of it. You accept it. You don't try and control it. You let it be. And you become interested in it. You investigate. You find out what it is. Mindfulness. Investigation. Not getting rid of it. Allowing it to be. Investigating. That is a classic Buddhist solution to boredom. And also to depression. Stop getting rid of it, because if you want to get rid of it, you're negative to your depression. I don't want to be depressed. That's the problem. Not the depression, but the way you relate to it. So be depressed. I demand my right to be depressed. And of course, you're not depressed then. You get out of it straight away by allowing it to be. Even sickness. I don't want to be sick. Allow yourself to be sick people's rights. We've got old people's rights. We've got children's rights. I'm going to stand up for sick people's rights. Sick people are being victimized and being oppressed. They're not allowed to be sick. Look, as soon as you're sick, some people in white coats bang you in a hospital and make you better again. Now, of course, I'm only just exaggerating here. If I was sick, I'd probably try and get better. But nevertheless, you can see the point here. When we don't accept life, we say sickness is wrong, we try and get rid of it, it makes the sickness much worse. Buddhist approach is not trying to control these things, not trying to sort of have a self which, there's something wrong with me today, this is not the real me. I'm supposed to be bright, extrovert, good fun to be with, that's the real me. We don't actually look at that at all. We don't have an idea of who we're supposed to be. Therefore, we can let go and just be whatever happens. All this idea of who you're supposed to be, where does that come from? Just at the airport in Melbourne, the plane was delayed, as it usually is. It's great for patients. What's wrong with the plane being delayed? A lot of people are getting angry. I've got an appointment. I got here early. I shouldn't be delayed. And of course, does that really help? Instead, if you're delayed and you're waiting for something, great, what a wonderful opportunity just to be patient, to let go. Who cares about what's going to happen next? But the reason I said this, because there was a big TV screen and I looked at it, and there was some TV program about people with cosmetic surgery. It was a psychology program. And somebody was saying that the reason you have cosmetic surgery, breast implants, cheek implants, lip implants, this apparently lady had all sorts of implants in there. She was Mrs. Implant. And it said, and some sort of guy on the TV said, your problem is, it's a psychological problem and you're focusing on the physical problem. Now why do you want to look like that? Just be yourself. Now, what do you look like? Are you happy with what you look like? Hands up if you're happy with what you look like. Why do we want to change ourselves? And who tells us to be different? A lot of times, the trouble with our idea of self and trying to make a self, we try and make a self which other people demand us to be. We're following other people's ideas of who we're supposed to be. We're trying to please others instead of trying to please ourselves. We're just following fads, fashions, and the demands of society, the demands of others. You may know, in a country where I come from, England, we are famous for our eccentrics. I remember reading of this one guy who lives in Manchester on the top of his roof, where he sleeps at night. He sleeps on a roof. He's got a house underneath the roof. He doesn't leave that for someone else. He sits on top of his roof. He's been doing it for years. He's very healthy, very happy. Eccentrics always are healthy and they live to a ripe old age. Now why do they do that? Why do they live to a ripe old age? Why are they healthy? Because they don't give a damn what other people think of them. They're at peace with whatever they want to be. Their idea of self is not controlled by other people's idea of what they're supposed to be. That's one of the great things of being a monk. Especially when I first came to Australia, it was wonderful. It's not so good these days. Because in the old days I used to be an eccentric. There's only about two of us. Now there's 20 or so monks in our monastery. You can't be eccentric as you used to be. But you see that when you can just be yourself, or whatever that is, changing from day to day, then you have this wonderful sense, it's eccentric, yeah, but you're free. You're not following like a sheep what other people are doing. You're not in the power of others. You're not have this idea, I have to look like this, I have to be like that. You can just, if you want to be bored, you can be bored. If you want to be extrovert, you can be extrovert. I know this psychologist yesterday, he said that you're born introvert or extrovert. That's your genes. It's in your, you can actually predict, he says, sort of, you know, who's going to be introvert and who's going to be extrovert. If you can ask my mother, she's still alive, I used to be so shy as a young kid. Now look at me. It can't be in my genes, unless I had some genetic, I've morphed into sort of something I shouldn't have been. Maybe it's all that radiation or something when I was living in England, I don't know. But anyway, even now, am I an introvert or an extrovert? I can get up and have fun with everybody and be as extrovert as you could be. But then I could also, I go into my cave, I've got this little cave in my monastery, and I'm an introvert. I really do look inside, I don't give a hoot about anybody else in the monastery. And I just hide. So I told this psychologist, I'm a schizophrenic. I've got this divided personality, half introvert and half extrovert. So what I was doing, I was rebelling against his categories, giving him a hard time. And it's great giving people a hard time. I love sort of, especially that every now and again. I remember having to go to the Centrelink once because I got this healthcare card. Yeah, I've got a healthcare card, don't have any money. I haven't got a cent. Literally. And so they used to actually ask me, well, how do you live? How can you survive? I said, quite well, thank you. Because I don't like that. And I think to actually get a card, you have to have all these, you have to like points to actually prove who you are. So I remember I turned up there one day and they said, well, you've got to prove who you are. Let's look at your bank account. No, I haven't got a bank account. I said, your mortgage? No mortgage. Driving license? I haven't got a driving license. What about marriage license? Oh, come on now. So I cannot prove who I am. I haven't got enough points. Isn't that great? Not be able to prove who you are, because it shows you I'm really living non-self. Even the Social Security can't prove who I am. And I know I can't prove, I've been trying my, all 30 years to try and prove who I am, I found out it's impossible to prove who you are. So, even according to Dhamma, each one of you, according to Dhamma, according to truth, haven't got enough points to prove who you are. I'm talking inside points. The point, the idea is it's wonderful not to have a sense of who you are. Which goes completely against the idea of psychology, to have this solid sense of identity. People have identity crises. I had an identity crisis years ago when I saw, you know, the emptiness of me. But it was a crisis which wasn't solved by trying to put in these ideas of a false identity, which is what most people do. People have this false identity. You can actually see them just the way they dress. There was this girl who came the other day. She said, you know, I dressed up like a gypsy. That was me. I was a gypsy girl. Or like me, when I was young, I was Jimi Hendrix. That's what I look like. One of these days, I'm going to put in the newsletter some old pictures of me. Some of my mother's got those old pictures. I had this frizzy hair out here. And just a big, where the hair ended, my beard started. I used to call it the donut look, because all hair around, there's a little hole in the middle where I could see. It was true. Well, green velvet trousers and my beads as well. That was on my motorbike. Vroom, vroom. You have to have hair when you're driving a motorbike because it's kept you warm. This is in England. It's really cold. Anyway, because that was my persona at the time. They get this idea of who you think you are. And You know, you're the life of the party, or you're the intelligent one. This is actually where we get in psychological problems. Isn't it great not to have any idea of who you are? Which means you can be anybody. It means you can be a fool. You can make mistakes. You can be brilliant. It means when you make mistakes, you don't worry about it. You don't think that that's you, that your sense of self has been challenged. When you get old, if your sense of self for young women is your beauty, your good looks, when they start to get old, it's not just, you know, worrying about being ugly. Your sense of self is challenged. When you lose control because something wrong happens in your life, your sense of being the master or the mistress gets challenged. That is the problem. And trying to overcompensate by saying, I'm going to decide who I'm going to be. I'm going to, okay, just to go and get a makeover. I'm going to go to the hairdressers. I'm going to go and get the face implants. I'm going to go get my teeth fixed up. I'm going to sort of do everything. I'm going to be the new person, the strong me. I remember someone telling me about this guy. You know, he was single, could never really find a partner. And his best mate just told him, look at yourself in the mirror. So if your teeth are all crooked and black, your hair's a mess, you know, look at you, really weak. Don't look after your personal appearance. And so he actually took him at his word. You know, and this is a joke, I can't hide it these days. This is today's joke. So he went to an expensive dentist, got bridges on his teeth, you know, crowns on the black ones. He went to the hair implants to get this really sort of rich hair on his head. He went to a personal trainer. That's how he was sitting next to a personal trainer on the way to Melbourne. Had a really nice discussion about training the mind or training the body. So actually, I'm a personal trainer. So you can all say you've got a personal trainer, Ajahn Brahm, trains your mind. Anyhow, so he went to the personal trainer, got really fit, and when he was really fit, great teeth, nice hair, and go to a, you know, a psychologist to get confidence, he also went to this expensive tailor to get this really sharp suit. And when he was all done, he went out for the first time. He looked sharp, confident, nice hair, nice teeth, good clothes. He was just going into the singles bar when he got hit by a truck and killed. And when he went up to heaven, he was just so angry at God. He said, look, I spent all this money, that 9 months of hard work, training, going through all this cosmetic surgery, which really hurts, cost a lot of money, straightening your teeth, personal training, and you didn't even let me have one night. Why did you do that? And of course God said, I'm very sorry, we didn't recognize you. Oh, you laughed. It's an old joke, but it's a good one. So don't waste your money that way. Put it in the donation box instead, much better. So instead of actually trying this psychological trauma, trying to be something you're not and putting all that effort in there, why don't you just accept that you're ugly? Just enjoy it. There's a young lady asking me earlier, because please don't worry about what you tell me afterwards. I won't tell you who it is. I'm not going to look at her. She was saying that, you know, she's a pretty girl. Her friends are jealous of her. So what should I do, if I'm pretty and other people are jealous of me? Should I sort of make myself ugly out of compassion? I said, no, look, sort of, I told her that old story that pretty girls have pretty girls suffering. Ugly ones have ugly girls suffering. And don't think that if you're different, you're going to get rid of the suffering. Do you know what it's like? If you've been pretty when you're very young, you get too many boys, and you get them for the wrong reasons. They want to go out with you, but they don't want to marry you. Because, you know, it's lovely going out with a pretty girl, but they know that the pretty girls, as it's said in the old Chinese proverb, never, this is for boys, never marry a pretty woman. And it's a very great proverb because there's a lot of sense behind it. If you marry a beautiful girl, she's relying on her looks to attract men. She doesn't develop any other sort of good qualities. She becomes lazy. Doesn't learn how to cook. She's not kind. She's not... And these are important things for a man. So if they've got an ugly girl, in order to get a partner in life, she has to learn how to be a really great cook, just be really, really kind, and just really, really gentle. That's the only way she can attract a partner. So if you get an ugly one, you're on a winner. So you can see that beautiful girls have beautiful girls suffering, ugly ones have ugly people suffering, the same with boys. So sometimes we're jealous because we think if we're like them, oh, we'd be so better, be so much happier. If we're rich, oh, if we win the lottery, then we'll be happy. And you know, I've said this before, rich people have rich person suffering. Poor people have poor person suffering. If you're poor and become rich, you don't just get happy, you just exchange one type of suffering for another type of suffering, that's all. And you ask rich people. I've known a few rich people in my life, and they're so lonely. They're afraid of friends and relations. Because every time a friend or relation comes by, they're always asking for something. For a loan, for a bit of money. Because that's what happens, and they're so scared, they can't trust anybody. That's the suffering of a rich person. You'll find many rich people become very lonely and isolated. It's one of the sufferings of the rich. So it's just one example there, that this is what happens when, you know, we look at other people and become jealous and we want to be somebody else. The point of Buddhist psychology is, look, let go, be yourself, whoever you are, allow that to be. Allow yourself to flow with life, with your body, with things. If you get bankrupt, fine. Doesn't matter, you can always go to Mallorca because that's where Scaisy went, isn't it? Now, that's not to be recommended. But when you become at peace with your life, you're understanding the Buddhist psychology, which is you can put forth effort. If there's something to do, you give it everything you've got. If there's nothing to do, you let go. So you're not trying to control life like the psychologists tell you to do. You're not trying to be something different. You're not trying to have this goal of who you want to be. And you go for it. Give everything you've got. Empower yourself. Make positive affirmations. You can do this. If you try that, you just go even more crazy. I think really the psychologists do this to get more business in the future. So they've always got clients. But as Buddhist monks, as Buddhism, as I told you all the time, we try and get rid of our disciples. We want an easy life. We try and get rid of you, so so you're enlightened, you're happy, you're peaceful, you never need to come to the Buddhist society anymore. And of course, I'm a great failure. Some of you have been kept coming here for like 20 years. I'm a great failure as a teacher. Imagine if I was a school teacher, and for 20 years people kept on coming back to the same class in school. Would that make me a great teacher? They wouldn't, I'd get the sack. So there's a different sort of understanding there. So with Buddhist psychology, the happiness doesn't come from achieving your goals. The happiness actually comes, the peace comes, the inner happiness comes for learning how to be content. And that is really challenging to our modern world. They say, keep on telling me, Ajahn Brahm, if you're content, you know, we wouldn't get on in the world. I say, exactly. You don't get on, you get in. Because getting on means in the future, more and more business, more moving. You never find any stillness. Instead of getting on in the world, get in the world. Get into this moment, get into life. Life, be in it. Not be on it, somewhere else. So what we're actually doing here is we're learning a very wonderful teaching of the Buddha. that you never find happiness over there in your goals. You find happiness in here, in being where you are. Sure, you have a few goals, you do things, you strive, but that's not the place where you'll ever find happiness. The happiness finds is not in the end of the journey, not in the beginning of the journey. The happiness lies in the pause, in the middle of the journey. You never reach a destination. I finish one plane trip and there's another plane trip coming next. You're always moving. But somewhere inside your mind is what I call the pause button. And you press the pause button in Buddhism. You pause and you rest. And there you find all the happiness you want. Not trying to be somebody else, not trying to go somewhere else, but being right here, right now, pausing. Because the Buddhist way of meditation is actually showing you from your personal experience about the way to happiness and the psychology of how to be at peace with yourself. Because for years I've been teaching people, look, just sit down and do nothing. And that's what people misunderstand me, actually to do the nothing. Come on, I've got to be peaceful. Or they say, come on, let go. I'm telling you, let go. Let go! Now come on me, let go. And of course, that's never the right way to meditate. That's not letting go, that's forcing yourself to let go. That's doing things, that's trying. Instead, in meditation, we allow ourselves to be who we are. There's nothing wrong with going to sleep in meditation. One of the stories from the Zen tradition, the founder of Rinzai tradition, Linchi, which, you know, people pronounce Rinzai, he was in the meditation hall in China. He later on went to Japan. And you know these Zen sesshins? You may have seen them on the television. Some of you may have actually been there. The master goes around with this big stick. Apparently during the rains retreat, they had a guy coming around with a big stick. Do you remember some of you see that? You see, they do it all the time. But in Japan, those masters were really fierce. And in the Zendo, these monks were meditating, and Rinzai, this was going to be this great master, this leader of one of the traditions, he was nodding, he was sleeping. And his head was way down. And when the master came in, the monk beside him gave him a nudge, look out, the master's coming, wake up, out of compassion and kindness. And this great Zen master, he opened one eye, only one eye, because that's enough, he's very efficient. He had one eye and saw his master and said under his breath, oh, it's only him, and carried on snoozing. And at that, the master blew up. He was enraged. And he said, all you stupid monks in this monastery, there's only one monk who understands Dharma, and that's Rinzai. Look at him, he's let go. There's some great teaching there. Because when I read that, I thought, hey, that's interesting. He didn't go around hitting Rinzai. Because Linchi was just being himself. He was tired, so he was nodding. What is wrong with that? But as for us, we've got this idea of we want to be enlightened. We want to be peaceful. We want to, you know, I've been talking about all these jhanas. There's even a book about jhanas. It's been translated into Chinese. And so everybody, we want to get jhanas. Have you got jhanas yet? Ask your friend. How's your meditation? Well, my meditation is much better than yours. You see how craving desire comes along. But no, you don't get those jhanas that way. Sometimes, actually, a question people asked after the talk last night in Melbourne. They say, isn't like trying to get jhanas or trying to get enlightenment the biggest ego trip of all? And I was telling them that no. For enlightenment, ego, she go, we all go. There's no one left in Nibbana. People actually groaned in Melbourne at that joke. You only laugh because you're kind. But there's this beautiful saying. This is in the Visuddhimagga, one of the great commentaries of meditation in our tradition. They say, it's a very beautiful, say the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. It's a very beautiful little poem. That the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. There's no ego, there's no self who walks that path. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. The ego drops, gets less and less and less. And so the path actually is not walked by you. It happens when you get out of the way. It's not a controlling. It's a letting go. It's a natural process. As my teachers used to always describe, the more you try, the more you're putting a barrier with the deepest meditation of all. So this is actually how we learn. We learn little things in our meditation. When you have a little bit of peace in your meditation, you're learning some psychological truths about yourself. The more you try, the more you screw it up. When you relax, everything gets very peaceful and still. Now what does that mean in your daily life? It means that the more you relax and let go, the more smoothly your life goes. The more psychological health you have. The more peace you are with the world and with others. The simile I've often given in meditation is when I used to ride a bicycle. When I first got on my bicycle when I was about, I don't know, 8 years of age, 9 years of age, I was so scared of falling off. I used to grip the handlebars until my knuckles went white and I'd always fall off. Until I learned that if you want to ride a bicycle, you relax. The more you relax, the more you will actually stay upright. Isn't that the case? And it's the same as in life. The more you relax and learn to flow with things, the more the body can adjust. When it gets tense and stiff, you can't adjust at all, you fall off. I used to hurt myself many, many times until I learned how to ride a bicycle. I used to hurt myself many, many times in meditation until I learned how to ride my mind in the same way as riding a bicycle. And when I was a monk, I used to hurt myself many, many times until I learned not to hold the handlebars of monkhood, until my mind got so white with tension. Instead I relaxed, and then you never fall off. Psychology. In marriage, sometimes you have a relationship and you cling so hard, you are so attached. Just you get so tense and tight and afraid and controlling, your marriage never lasts. Who wants to live with a control freak? But when you relax and let go, you're fun to be with. And then you have a very strong relationship. It stays upright, just like me on my bicycle. So this is a powerful psychology of success in life, especially the success in your happiness and peace and well-being. You don't get depressed. Why do you get depressed? Because I don't want things to go wrong. In my life as a monk, I say, when things go wrong, welcome. I almost missed my first talk in Melbourne because the plane was 2 hours late. I missed my lunch. I didn't eat that day. Oh, isn't that wonderful, going without lunch? I'm trying to lose weight. It's a great way of going on a diet. But I did make up for it when I was in Melbourne. So as a monk, you actually learn, as a Buddhist you learn, when you don't control the life, because whatever happens, there's always something you can do with it. There's always something you can learn. And for me, nothing can go wrong. Not because I control things, because whatever happens is right. So if someone actually throws a tomato at me, that's great, I can actually keep that for tomorrow and make it into a stew. Whatever, please don't get there any ideas though. So whatever happens, if I get sick, I can take a rest. When I go to the dentist, they've got the most wonderful chairs. We don't have chairs like that in our monasteries, that's why I like going to the dentist. It's one occasion where I can really relax and there's really lovely chairs. They're nice. And when I die, that's great. That's why I'll really get rid of you that day. So whatever happens, you're never afraid. It's never something goes wrong. It's just, here comes life. And you accept life. You're at peace with life. You say something stupid. And you actually, you laugh at it as well. When you say something stupid. I think I was gave this talk. But no, that's something I have about mindfulness, about the guard watching a wealthy person's house. I made a mistake. I said it was the burglar watching the wealthy person's house while the guard went inside to steal the things. I made a real mess of it. Isn't that funny? I thought that's really funny. I laughed at myself for doing that, for making a fool of myself. It's one of the things I learnt when I was even a school teacher. When you make a mistake in front of a class of kids, it was a wonderful teaching, because you're standing in front of a class of, you know, of high school children, and you really got to be on your ball, because they're looking for any opportunity to make a fool of you, to ridicule you. I remember once I had hay fever. And I went up into the class, and I should have actually taken a day off. I was sniffing, you know, trying to actually to give the lesson, you know, without sort of interrupting them by blowing my nose. And in 5 minutes, you had 30 kids there facing me, go, all irritating me. You know what kids are like, and I just laughed. Because I was taught, if you make a fool of yourself, and the kids laugh, you laugh as well. And then, no one laughs at you, they're only laughing with you. And that's actually brilliant psychology. And it's not just in front of a class of school kids, it's not just like when giving a talk at the Buddhist Society or on TV or whatever. If you make a mistake in life, and life laughs at you, you don't get depressed. You laugh with life. I've lost my job. What a great joke. Now you can sleep in on a Monday morning. It's brilliant. So something will turn up eventually, just especially if you've got a happy mind. But if you get depressed and angry, you can never get a job. Even when you go for a job and you get interviewed. And if you're a happy person, happy-go-lucky and sort of got a good mind, of course people will hire you. Again, because do you really want to work, you know, with a sourpuss? You know, with someone who always gets angry and upset. You know, when things go wrong in the office, they just, you know, get depressed. That's no way to actually earn a living. So that way, you can actually learn from this Buddhist psychology how to be successful in life. When things go wrong, so-called wrong, they're not wrong, they're right. It's a joke. It's a laugh. You laugh with life, and then life never laughs at you. How can you become depressed or upset? You're finding a psychology which transcends the sufferings and the miseries of life. No longer is anything deserves the word miserable. It's bad weather, when you're sort of having a sort of a function. It's a marvelous opportunity. It's only rain. We call it holy water. Because it comes from the heavens, it must be holy. So when there's a function we have and it rains, I would say it's holy water today. It's auspicious. And then, the next time there's a ceremony in our monastery and it's a beautiful day, I said, look at the beautiful day, see, it's auspicious. When it's cloudy, it doesn't rain, it doesn't shine, I said, isn't it nice and cool, it's a great meditation weather. And whatever happens, you enjoy it. Now, see, you can see what happens now. You're moving with life rather than trying to control it. You're not fighting the world. You're making peace with the world. You're not fighting yourself and the way yourself changes from day to day, from year to year. You're making peace with the seasons of yourself. The way the mind, your heart changes from day to day. The days when you're just so kind and compassionate. You're at peace with that. The times when you are just so stingy and mean, you become at peace with that too. And actually, then you're not stingy and mean anymore. But this way, you're learning to be at peace with life. Now that becomes the goal which psychology tries to reach for, but never attains. It's a goal which Buddhists have known for a long time, and they know the path to reach it. The path of contentment, the path of letting go. The path of being at peace, not trying to make a self and affirm a self, not trying to make goals. The psychologist was actually saying, he said, one of the things he said, it's been proven, he said, if you don't have physical touch, you don't have someone to hug you. So touch, skin to skin, is such an important, crucial part of a person's happiness. It's been shown and been proven, he said, that without physical touch, you get depressed, you get lonely, and you get sort of psychologically screwed up. And I said, well, I must be psychologically screwed up because I haven't been touched by a woman in 30 years. I'm a monk. He didn't like that. So it's again, it's great being a monk. Not only does the social security or Centrelink really sort of have a lot of trouble with us, so do psychologists. I'm supposed to be a deviant. I am, because I'm celibate. Celibacy is supposed to be the biggest of the sexual deviancies. Because people say that sexual activity is a normal part of a human life. It's in your genes, it's in your hormones, and if you don't express that, you get all screwed up. That's me. I haven't had sex for over 30 years. And of course it's wrong, and I love actually proving things wrong. You're a rebel. And I always wanted to be a rebel. Now, I was to tell about the Jimi Hendrix haircut, and there's also the green velvet jeans as well. And I really thought I was a rebel until I went to one of these big rock concerts. I think one of the first ones, I actually went to the Lovins at Woburn Abbey, for anyone who's old enough to remember those. Yeah, Lovins in Woburn Abbey, that was really good. And actually, when I went there, of course, I was just so disappointed, because I saw about 10,000 other people with green velvet trousers and... and big hair and hippie beats. And I realised I wasn't being a rebel after all. So these days, I realised how you can really rebel. Just be yourself, whatever that happens to be, and allow yourself to change. When you wake up in the morning, whoever you are that day, you're at peace with that. Throughout the day, you change many times. Allow yourself to be that. So in the end, you don't know who's the real you, because there isn't a real you. You can adapt and change the situations. Yesterday I was welcoming people as they came into the big hall. I was the extrovert. Monday, when I go back to my monastery in Serpentine, I'll go in my cave and be the hermit. Which one is the real me? None of them are. You can just change. Not have a solid sense. Are you the wife? Are you the husband? When you're with your partner, you are the wife or the husband. But when you're alone, you're you. You've been born many times. Now you may be the man. Next time you're the woman. Maybe even the animal. Maybe the heavenly being. Which one is the real you? None of them is the real you. It's just little changes which we have. We can be at peace with change. Don't try to be at peace with stability, with solidity, because that's called attachment, grasping. And you'll never find peace that way. So we're at peace with change. We're in peace with non-self. We're at peace with dukkha, with suffering. We know that things, sometimes we don't get what we want. We're at peace with that. So the three characteristics of existence, which the Buddha taught, unsatisfactoriness, non-self, change, impermanence. That's life. We're at peace with that. In fact, we can even say we have compassion to the way things are. We have compassion to the way we are. We have compassion to the way life is. We say, life, the door of my heart is open to you. Whatever you are, cancers or health, life or death, success or failure, pain or whatever, the door of my heart is open to all of you. That's called being at peace. That's Buddhist psychology. I think that works. And that's the talk for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it. So, if you didn't enjoy it, that's okay also. Any questions, comments or complaints? Now is your big chance. Comments, complaints or questions? The three C's. Yes, it probably thought it was in my genes that I changed from being an introvert into being an extrovert. But maybe I've got two pairs of jeans and I change every morning. That's actually one of the things in psychology. Thank you for bringing that up. If actually you believe what the doctors say, that you're sick, you can become sick. If you believe what the psychologists say, that you know you are an introvert, you would actually, if you believe that, you become an introvert. If you believe what I say, you can become that as well. So don't believe me. I might say that to a fellow monk. Look, whatever I say, don't believe it. And he believed it, because he didn't believe me. I think it's a bit late for philosophical jokes. So yeah, thank you for that. Any other question? Yes, we've got one over there. Yeah, you said that many of us are at the mercy of society's expectations. Being a monk, can you sidestep that? For the time being, we can, because you don't know what we're supposed to be doing, so you don't have expectations of us. But if we're here long enough, you'll expect something of us. So you expect me to give a talk every Friday night. Some of you expect a joke. Sometimes you get one, sometimes you don't. You always expect the jokes to be terrible, and sometimes they're actually good. I'm sorry to disappoint you. But it's true, society's expectations sort of a terrible causes of psychological pressure. But you know, who is society anyway? And who are we listening to? Sometimes it's the TV, sometimes it's Oprah Winfrey, or sometimes it's the magazines which you read, or the TV, whatever it is. Those are sometimes, we actually just allow ourselves to be disempowered by those expectations. That's why it's great to be eccentric. Because then you're sort of, you know, you're putting up two fingers against what society expects of you. And of course, I think that we always want to have freedom. And you know, Australia is supposed to be a free country. And this is actually one point I never mentioned in that talk. The identification of freedom with happiness. Real freedom is happiness. Real happiness is freedom. But what real freedom is needs to be understood. And the freedom is that the freedom of desires. So freedom from desires, sorry. So society's desires, we're free from those. And our own desires, we're free from those as well. So whatever people ask of you, you don't listen to them. Whatever you ask of you, you don't listen to that either. You're free from the desires which tend to push and pull you in life. Expect to your own expectations and society's expectations. Throw them all away. And that way, you just no expectations. You can be at peace, you can be free. Who knows what's going to happen next? You know that when I give a talk, I haven't got a clue what I'm going to talk about. I haven't got any expectations of what I'm going to say. And it always comes out much better when you have no expectations, no plans. You just flow with the moment. That's how Ajahn Chah taught us to teach. Never to prepare a talk, but to be prepared to talk at any time. Just to allow yourself to be free. When you actually free the mind, that's why I like meditating before I give a talk, because the mind gets nice and free and peaceful. You're not afraid of anything, you're not trying to control anything, you just allow the words to come out, and you have fun. That's actually how to live life, whatever you have to do. Not following society's expectations, not your expectations, no one's expectations. Just allow life to happen. Great question, thank you. Did it answer it though? I hope you didn't expect an answer. Okay, so I think that's enough for tonight. So again, thank you for listening. Now we have